That phone call came, he was rushing. I could tell he wasn't himself. And I said to him, I said, what's up? He says, I have had enough of this shit. I'm going to Washington. I'm going to meet with the nuncio. I am blowing the whole crap out of the water. Couple months pretty much to deal with the reality of death, of so-called suicide. And I knew from the get-go it wasn't suicide.
Please keep in mind that all parties mentioned in this podcast are innocent until proven guilty, and all opinions expressed by interview subjects are their own. We know the mysterious death of Father Joe has more layers than an onion, and over a year after we started our investigation in Buffalo, this case is still unfolding before our eyes. Almost every week since we released the podcast, a new priest, seminarian, parishioner, or policeman has come forward to talk to us about Father Joe. There have been baffling coincidences, colliding between conversations and phone calls, connecting rabbit holes under Buffalo like subway tunnels of secrets. Seriously, the past 2 weeks, Rachel has been on the phone for hours, sometimes 6 to 8 hours a day. She is like a true crime miner with multiple crime mine shafts, like separate dig sites for each rabbit hole. And Rachel is typically a subterranean mile ahead of me, digging through these research rabbit holes. And when she surfaces, she always has something to tell me that thickens the plot. We know this story is long and at times convoluted, so thank you for sticking with us through the exposition of how we found ourselves in Buffalo, New York, in December, knocking on rectory doors, unraveling this story. And you guys gotta remember, we're still not even done telling you about our first trip to Buffalo in 2021. Before we left Buffalo, we wanted to get eyes on the two guys who were at the church before police arrived in Father Joe's office with no supervision. Deacon Paul and David LaPuma. David LaPuma has been in the Good Old Boys Club of the Buffalo Diocese for years. At this point in 2012, LaPuma had been secretary to the two previous bishops, Manziel and Kimmick, acting as the hand establishing the long-running culture of corruption that has powered the diocese, covering up crimes and ignoring abuse. The bishop's favorite, LaPuma has skillfully climbed the diocesan ladder, priming himself for a future appointment to bishop. And before Bishop Malone was ousted, he appointed Monsignor David LaPuma, rector of Our Lady of Victory Basilica, the crown jewel of the Buffalo Diocese. And that's where we're headed now.
We made our plan to see David LaPuma first. And walking into the basilica that he reigned over, I thought it was one of the most beautiful churches I'd ever seen. It rivaled holy gathering places in Europe. I was nervous when we walked in, but I was looking forward to getting the chance to speak to David LaPuma. I thought about the times that I went to Catholic Mass as a kid, and the priest always shook hands with parishioners after and spoke to them, so I assumed it would be the same situation. So when communion was called, I went forward and he blessed me. He was kind and much less intimidating than I could have guessed. Smaller in stature and kind of meager. But there was something about him that I didn't trust. He wasn't, like I said, scary in size or threatening in his stance. He just gave me a smarmy, sinister vibe. So I was eagerly awaiting the end of the Mass where I could finally speak to the man that was appointed to the best church in Buffalo, a man that was there the day Father Joe died, a man who never went to St. Lawrence Church, but was there before the police, in the rectory. In fact, the first phone call was not to 911 when Deacon Paul allegedly discovered Father Joe. It was to David LaPuma. And before police arrived after that delayed 911 call, Deacon Paul and David LaPuma did some rearranging in Father Joe's rectory. According to the witness on site named Maddie, he heard them moving stuff around in the rectory. And when all was said and done, key items were missing from Father Joe's rectory. This was the diocese damage control. His file cabinet was gone. No documents past 2010 were found there. His fax machine, gone. His safe, gone. Laptop, never seen again. And this was one of the men I was hoping to speak to that day. So the Mass ends. LaPuma, and I'm not joking, acted like Beyonce. Essentially, the stage mechanically descended. It didn't, but you get the point. But he basically finishes Mass, goes to a door under the stage, and never shows his face to the eager parishioners. No humble handshakes, no peace be with you, just poof, out. The star had taken his bow for the day. So then I decided to set myself up for more disappointment that day, because we were leaving Buffalo very soon. But believing that any of these guys would actually talk to us was a fool's errand. But not to be deterred, Deacon Paul was next on my list that day. I was going to talk to him. I pitched to Greg that we should go to Deacon Paul's house. Before I even pitched to Greg, I'd already found his address and had made this plan in my head. So basically, Greg had to go with me. But here's the thing. We didn't have Joe Wedge as our chauffeur that day because he had to work. So the only way to get there was to call an Uber, which was a pretty awkward Uber drive. Because obviously, if I'm like just springing this on Greg, we're going to need to talk about our plan of attack in the car ride there. So there's no way we're going to get away with just like, hey, we're going to our buddy's house. Like, we had to tell the Uber driver. Additionally, we also had to ask the Uber driver to wait for us, so we weren't stranded there after an awkward encounter.
Maybe pull further down the street. Go away so you're not involved or even close to it.
Which house is it?
Right there? Oh, with the W's on it. Yeah. Oh, they're there. Okay. So you go a little further so...
Yeah, that's good.
If they do shoot us, you won't be involved.
They're not shooting us.
I'm just joking. Alert ya. Or you can right just back. Like look in your rearview mirror.
I'm
going to
leave some stuff in here.
Okay. I didn't hear it ring. Do we look like we're robbing them? Use the knocker? See the gold?
Give it a second. Might take a minute or a little bit.
Hi!
Hi, how's it going?
I'm about to take a shower.
Sorry about that. We're conducting a piece.
His excuse was odd at best. That his wife was currently in the shower and he was about ready to jump in. It was 2:30 p.m. I don't know if they were showering together. I don't really want to think about it. But it really seemed like a nervous, off-the-cuff, not well-thought-out excuse.
I'm sorry, yeah.
No problem.
My wife's in the shower. I'm getting ready.
Hey, no problem. Thank you for... Well, maybe we'll find your number and call you or something, too.
Okay,
All right, thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Yeah. Hey, we didn't get killed.
Turns down, he said he was naked getting in the shower.
Yeah, he's an old man. But he said we can contact him later. He seemed flustered.
Deacon Paul Weisenberger and his wife, Mary, are key suspects in this investigation. There is motive, evidence, and unanswered questions behind Deacon Paul's handling of Father Joe's death. Deacon Paul made two very deliberate choices after supposedly discovering Father Joe's dead body. One, he called David LaPuma before he called the police. And two, he told the police it was a suicide. How was he so sure? On the day Father Joe died, just hours before his death, he was at the City Center Grocery Corner Market across the street from St. Lawrence, buying lottery tickets for the next day. Wouldn't you think someone, even on the end of their rope, would at least wait until the numbered ping pong balls had delegated their fate before they would end it? Don't you think they would hold out to check their lottery picks and see if they won the $16.5 million jackpot that was on the table that weekend? The psychology of purchasing a lottery ticket is built on an impulse of hope that despite the immense odds, the pleasant daydream of a sudden influx of millions of dollars could liberate anyone from their daily stresses. And for a guy like Father Joe, the amount of good he could do with that kind of money, I just think he would have waited for the numbers to be drawn. During our first trip to Buffalo, we went to the city market on Delavan Avenue that sits adjacent from the front doors of St. Lawrence's Chapel. And to our luck, the same clerk who rang Father Joe up the Saturday he died was working.
Were you here when he bought the lottery ticket? Was it you? Yes. He bought the lottery ticket from you.
He come play his number and he left and he paid whatever he was owed some money. I think the time he paid half of it and the rest he said he would pay come back inside. But I see a lot of police. I say, what's going on? And I was waiting. The lady, she say, you know Father Joe? I say, yeah. She say somebody. He got shot, something like that. So I was shot one day. So
wow.
We miss him. He's a good person.
That makes me happy.
Really, we miss him. I remember him. He was cooking over there.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, he walked to the street, in the middle of the street, to give people hot dog, beef, anything they cooked. He was a good person, really.
Wow.
And we always put his picture on.
They still have Father Joe's photo hanging up in their store behind the counter. He is familiar with many fond memories of Father Joe. The store, owned by the clerk's brother, had a trusted relationship with the priest, allowing him to pay for things on credit. And Father Joe would always come in the next day and pay, he says.
No more than that. Even the church, he was busy, the church, when he was there.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he was alive.
He mentions how the church was alive when Father Joe was there and recounts funny memories of the jolly priest bringing him food from the church cookouts, pantomiming a larger-than-life waddle from behind the counter of this little market.
He gave me a hot dog. He said, no, I'll go back and give you the chicken. He's a good person. Yeah, I will say, I remember him. Really, I am one of the person I miss him. I miss Father Joe a lot.
Aww.
From my heart. Really, he was a good person. Especially to me, I was working in the morning all the time, coming here. Hey, you need anything? I can help you. It's a good person.
It's heartbreaking.
Really, from the heart.
Even after 10 years, Father Joe's footprint remains embedded in this underprivileged community. Even our Lyft driver, Tamika, who picked us up to take us to the city market, knew Father Joe. She used to play bingo at St. Lawrence and lived in a nearby neighborhood.
He was murdered, but they ruled it a suicide and covered it up. You know anything about Father Joseph Moreno?
Yes, and I actually used to play bingo there. Like I said, I'm not sure what
goes
on. Is he heavy set curly hair?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, heavy set curly hair.
And she says he was a very friendly guy and mentions that the story pushed in the media was not how the neighborhood felt. There were rumors pushed by the church that Father Joe had a gambling problem. But from everyone we've talked to, that does not seem to be the case. Sure, he liked to buy a couple $2 lotto tickets, and he would go with buddies from the Buffalo PD to casinos from time to time. Catholic churches all over the country have bingo nights with cash prizes. And after all, isn't God the curator of chance? We left off last episode at the crime scene, the day Father Joe died. However, to understand the circumstances surrounding a rectory that is now taped off and crawling with cops, firefighters, and first responders, we must push the clock back even farther and rewind another month to September 12, 2012, when the diocese requests an audit of St. Lawrence. The audit was supposed to only last 7 to 10 days, but it lasted a month, and Father Joe was there every morning while Beth Pericosi did the audit. And she mentioned Father Joe was an excellent record keeper. It should be noted that on September 28th, the cleaning lady for St. Lawrence, Carol, noticed that Father Joe's 357 was missing from his dresser drawer when she was putting his clothes away. This was not the gun found at the crime scene. This was a 357 Magnum that was Father Joe's. But it goes missing weeks before his death? Pretty strange. On October 3rd, a letter from the Chancery came, addressed simply to St. Lawrence Parish, revealing that Father Butch Mazur was going to take over as administrator at St. Lawrence Parish for the next year. And this is how Father Joe essentially found out that he was being reassigned. Parishioners were up in arms, distraught over this switch. They were going to Father Joe crying, very upset that Father Butch Mazur was going to take over St. Lawrence. And they knew the Chancery's plan was to close St. Lawrence, just like St. Gerard's, the last place Butch Mazur was at. The Chancery received over 700 letters and emails in 2 days about Father Mazur's new appointment. And they wanted Father Joe to stay. It's now October 5th, and Father Joe is working on an annulment. This is something he would have never left undone. The next day, October 6th, is a Saturday. Father Joe's got a full slate. Like every Saturday, he celebrates Mass at 11 a.m., 3 p.m., hears confession at 3:45, 4:30 p.m., and 10 p.m. every Saturday. And he always had the church filled to capacity, even though St. Lawrence isn't in the best of neighborhoods. That night, he wrote the announcement letter of the new administration change for the parish. He was upset at the nerve the diocese had to just send a letter, not even to his attention or to Deacon Paul's. On October 8th, Father Joe texts Reverend Ted. "Hi, Ted. If you hear of any guys looking for help during the weekdays and Saturdays after October 17th, pass my cell number on to them. Thanks. Things are bad here. People are so upset, crying, angry. Wow." St. Lawrence Parish was in turmoil over this decision. On October 9th, Father Joe has a meeting with Bishop Malone to decide his next assignment. Father Joe told Sue that the bishop said it was going to take 4 to 8 weeks to get his new assignment, and Father Joe said the meeting went well for the most part. He also told Sue, "If I do not get my assignment by then, I will go to the media and the newspapers with secrets of the diocese, proof of embezzling, pedophilia, and gross sexual misconduct of certain priests." He was riled up, and rightfully so, for the disrespectful way the diocese informed him of his reassignment. But he was hopeful for hospital ministry, and it seemed like Bishop Malone wanted to grant him that. October 10th. Father Joe and Sue talked 5 times that day. She said he was very upbeat, happy, he had a lot to do, but he was super excited because he learned that a parishioner had left their house to him, and he was already making plans to paint it, landscape, you know, spruce it up. He also made plans with a Kenmore Department firefighter named Brendan Finn to go out to dinner the following week. In text messages to Brendan, he said, "Saw the bishop today. I will be leaving at the end of October. Butch Mazur administrator for 1 year. Church will probably close, and I'm going to stay with Paul Seal until I get my new assignment. Hopefully hospital ministry." And maybe the most telling proof that Father Joe had no intention on killing himself that weekend was that he scheduled his colonoscopy for the following week that day. Who would take the time to schedule that appointment if they had any intention on ending their life? October 11th. The audit ended. Father Joe told Sue that $500,000 was missing and not accounted for. He did not know where it went. They were on the phone for about an hour, and in that conversation, he told her he did not trust Deacon Paul. She asked if he was safe, and he said, "Susie, I can take care of myself." Joe also called Sister Dempsey that day, a retired nun who he had known for over 25 years. Of that conversation, she said, "Joe was perfectly fine. He had a lot to do, absolutely good. He loved people, loved life. He would not kill himself." And Joe said that he was coming out to see her. And after 25 years, she knew his habits and his moods. On October 12th, the day before his death, the secretary at St. Lawrence, Debbie, said Father Joe was fine. Saw him at 2 p.m. Friday. He was packing and putting things in the pod. He also used his Friday to pay his Erie County taxes on the house he had just inherited. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm planning on killing myself, I'm definitely not paying my taxes on a house I just inherited the day before. And in addition to that, he paid his cell phone bill, a bank bill, and a doctor bill that day, as well as depositing a $900 mass stipend check to do 60 masses for another priest. He planned on doing these masses. And on that Friday night, Father Joe got into a heated argument in the rectory's kitchen at St. Lawrence with Auxiliary Bishop Grosch and Butch Mazur, which reportedly involved a shoving match and nearly came to blows. So now that we have a broader view of the events that led up to Father Joe's death and what took place in the immediate hours after, we can start to build a suspects list. First up, the man who discovered him, Deacon Paul. How did Deacon Paul know to show up at the rectory at 3:45 p.m. on a Saturday with his keys for a door that's typically unlocked to find Father Joe before anyone else did? According to phone records, he had not been calling Father Joe trying to get a hold of him. And remember, Father Joe had told Sue earlier that week, after the audit uncovered $500,000 missing from the church, that he did not trust Deacon Paul. And we've been told this was money the Weisenbergers could have needed, for reasons we won't get into here. On top of that, because Father Joe was being reassigned from St. Lawrence, Deacon Paul was also losing his position at the parish. Catholic deacons do get paid a modest salary, and from what we've gathered, it doesn't appear that Paul Weisenberger was ready to lose that job. And conveniently enough, after Father Joe's death, Deacon Paul was made permanent deacon to the parish. He even gave the homily at Mass the very next day. Something else just to consider, if you're thinking why the cops might not have considered Deacon Paul a suspect the day of at the crime scene, is that we've been told old Deacon Paul's a little bit of an amateur actor. Next up, David LaPuma. As told to us by a source within the diocese, LaPuma was on damage control after Father Joe's death. He was first on the scene and destroyed evidence, they say. And a story that has been corroborated by multiple sources as we've been investigating says David LaPuma gave a homily during a mass for a group of nuns the following day, where he went on and on about there being so much blood. That certainly wasn't a memory from the crime scene we saw. There was no blood in the crime scene photos. Not on the floor, not on the windowsill, and almost none in the chair he was found in. Butch Mazur. Who else but the closer? The henchman the diocese sends in to shut down a church. Before taking over St. Lawrence, Butch Mazur had previously closed down the last two churches he was at, St. Anne's and St. Gerard's. This guy looks like a mean linebacker. And Joe was fiercely against Father Mazur taking over the church. In text Joe sent the morning of his death, he said, "The selection of priest Father Butch Mazur is not a good fix for St. Lawrence. During the Faith and Grace journey, he was very destructive with his mouth and negative comments about Father Paul Seal and the parishioners of St. Lawrence. Tell the news how you feel. Thanks, Father Joe." And then the fight on Friday night, with Mazur and Grosch in the kitchen. What was that about? What would make these men of God lose their tempers to the point of near violence? We will go into Father Butch Mazur in a later episode, but know that aside from slinking around the parking lot of St. Lawrence while the cops were in there, sources claim for years Butch would bring it up out of nowhere, that he was certain Father Joe did kill himself. And he would get angry defending his point, slamming his fist on the table, "He killed himself!" Lastly, the big boss, the head pedophile protector, Eddie Grosch. We've detailed some of Auxiliary Bishop Grosch's work behind the diocese scandals in earlier episodes, but to further understand his role both as a perpetrator and a protector of sexual abuse in the diocese, we have to go to an abandoned Dairy Queen's parking lot across the street from St. Lawrence, and next to the city market, where there is a giant big rig parked. And we're about to climb into the cab of this semi to meet with one of Father Joe's great friends and a former seminarian, who we know as Jonathan. You will notice that he's Polish immediately from his thick accent.
So going back to Joe, so Joe knew when I came to Buffalo in 1990, I shared with Joe certain things. I mean, what happened was in 1991, I was invited by the bishop of this diocese, Bishop Edward Groves, to go with him during the summer to Poland as a translator with his pilgrimage. He paid for the trip. Was very nice to me at the beginning. Excellent. Everything was just open highway. Until a very strange event took place. And the event was, the second day after that arrival, we went to the salt mines. In Poland, there is a very famous place in Krakow, outside Krakow, it's called Wieliczka, where for hundreds of years, probably over 1,500 years, they were digging salt from underground, and the process, it's pretty much a mine, but they also created different sculptures made of salt.
Oh, cool.
It's very kind of artistic.
My parents
have been
there.
Really?
Yeah. So here you go. Cool. So you go underground and this and that. So what happened was, the second day as we went, and I went with the group in the morning, like everybody was supposed to get her. I didn't pay attention to anybody other than being in the group. I went with those people, and during some time in the afternoon, still in the mind, people saying, "Well, where's Bishop? Where's Bishop Groves?" They really wanted to know where the bishop was, and I didn't know. So we came, when we were coming back, people were like, "Why don't you go and find out where's the bishop? I mean, maybe he's sick, maybe what? We haven't seen him. Have you seen him?" So I went to the receptionist, I found out his room number, and I went to see the room. As I came to the door was not completely shut. Knock, nobody responds. Pushed it through. "Hello, anybody there?" And there was two of them, bishop and another priest of the Diocese of Buffalo by the name Gresak.
Oh.
Father Gresak. And just two underage boys in there. I didn't know who they were, where they came from, any of it. This was around between 5 and 7 p.m. Maybe 7 and 8 p.m. I don't know exactly the timeline.
How did you know they were underage? You could just tell.
You could tell.
Yeah.
You could tell. And one was watching TV, and the other one was playing something with Gresak, whatever. I didn't make much of it other than I found the bishop Bishop was actually sleeping. So Grassack told me, asked me, "Whoa, what are you doing here?" I go, "Well, I'm looking for everybody that's asking for Bishop. Is everything okay?" Yeah, okay. I backed out. I went downstairs, told people that Bishop is okay. He's sleeping. Maybe he got tired, whatever. I don't know. Everybody got happy at that point. Went to my room. But I was staying by myself in the suite. Just happened to be that I was in the suite by myself. Then, maybe 45 minutes, I get knock on the door. Open it up. Here's the Bishop. "Don't you ever come to my room like that." He's all pissed off. I'm like, "Why is he flipping?" Hey?
Yeah, what he's got to hide.
Well, you remember, I'm 24 years old, 23 years old. I have no experience about all this crap.
Yeah.
I have no even thinking at that point that two underage boys, I mean, I was underage boy too, and I've been with priests and different pilgrimages and stuff. Nothing ever happened, nothing ever of that nature or magnitude, mm-hmm. right? What happened was the following morning at the breakfast, one of the boys was not there, they didn't look very good. So I asked, I said, "What's the matter with you?" And the tears coming down.
Oh, he started crying.
He was crying. The other, his friend was like, "I'm looking." I said, "No, don't ask him. I'm like, what's going on?" And he blows at me. He goes, "You would be crying too if somebody was putting hands in your ass."
Oh my gosh.
What? Oh, hands on your ass or something like that. He did say it in Polish.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "What do you mean? He got hit?" I said, "Nah." And then I look in the corner of the eye and the Grassack and Gross is coming down. So I got away. So fast forward, I come back to the United States. They came before me. And then the priest I was with, who picked me up at Toronto at the airport, right after he picked me up in the vehicle, he goes, "What happened in Poland?" Well, he goes, "What happened in Poland? Tell me." I'm like, "Whoa, nothing happened." "Well, something happened because Bishop called me and he said that you're very ungrateful."
Wow. Very ungrateful.
But ungrateful. And I'm like, Then my investigator mind starts kicking in. I'm like, I'm not a Colombo, but I'm not stupid anymore. Why is he flipping? What's going on here? Then I'm collecting things. Then there was a Christmas party.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Christmas party of 91 at John Paul II residence up there. They had on Title Street.
Mm-hmm.
So I participated in that, and that's how I met Joe. And Joe came and was at the party, and I didn't know him from Squawk. I didn't know him from, I never met him before. He goes, "Are you Wes?" Yeah, he says, "Let's walk. Let's have a talk." So I go home to talk. He goes, "You be very careful because some powerful person doesn't like you."
Wow.
I said, "Who's this?" He goes, "I don't want to get it wrong." I said, "You be very careful. You be very careful around the Pollock." So he told me that, he goes, "You be very careful what you say in the seminary too. But something ain't right."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Father Joe, what's not right?" He goes, "What happened in Poland?" And I told him.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe was kind of a straightforward guy. And he goes, "Motherfucker."
Good.
And I'm like, he says, "He is known to be touching kids around here."
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, "Touching what?" Because remember, I'm still kind of naive. I don't know about those things.
Yeah.
He goes, "Well, he has, before the kids go, altar boys, before they go to the mass, he's touching their biceps and he's touching their thighs and things like this. And this guy is weird."
Mm-hmm. This is
was back in 1990.
This is 1991.
Oh my God.
So they already knew, of course, in clerical circles, they know everything. They are worse than the old ladies, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, all respect to the old ladies, you know, but they know everything. They know about each other, they know about gossips, they know about the truth, and they know about the false. They know everything. Come on.
Yeah.
Let's be real here.
I can't believe, and he only temporarily was ousted, but is he back?
Who?
Gross.
He's not ousted. He is retired and stuff. But remember, this guy was in charge of the investigation of the child sexual abuse cases. He was running the diocese because when I was in the seminary here, mm-hmm. the Bishop Head, who was the head, mm-hmm. they used to call him Head without a head. He had a mansion on Long Island, mm-hmm. 16 Bishop's Place in Hempstead. Have you ever been on Long Island, Hempstead?
The real rich area?
I haven't
been, but I know of.
How about $25 million?
The house was?
Huh?
Where's the money coming from?
Catholic Charities. He was a New York City Catholic Charities boy. Come on.
So that's probably even bigger than the one house we're going to later today.
16 Bishop's Place. Check it out.
Okay.
I've been to the place.
Were they throwing parties there too?
I don't know what they had, but the story is that he had family living there. Family meaning a lady with a number of children. We don't know who is the real father of those children. We don't know that.
Oh, like he had a wife or something?
Yeah, double lie, I see.
I'm not accusing, but it's kind of coincidental that there was a lady, she had no husband, but she had a couple of kids, and
yeah,
no. Age was close and stuff, and you know, it's...
They're so full of shit.
It's maybe a sister, maybe a good neighbor, I don't know.
In the last hours of his life, Father Joe bought lottery tickets he'd never see the drawing for, and he did his taxes. Lottery tickets and taxes. Now, certainly nothing is more certain than death. However, what are the odds that a priest, who liked to play the lottery, would play the numbers only to kill himself before the result, combined with paying his taxes on a house he just inherited, and a pending lawsuit that could award him over $1 million set to settle in January? He had good reason to keep living. And what are the odds someone who had made future plans that morning would decide in the middle of the day, after buying lottery tickets, to take a gun with their non-dominant hand and shoot themselves in the backside of their head, sitting in a recliner with their legs crossed? What are the odds? What are the odds the missing $500,000 Father Joe found in the audit was a motive for wanting him dead? What are the odds a priest guarding secrets with a meeting on Monday with the Papal Nuncio of Rome would be removed from the equation before he could reveal what he knew to the Vatican?